So there is a sermon written, but I feel very awkward giving a sermon to a small crowd. It feels more appropriate that we share our thoughts and reflections. What? No, it isn't. It's not. Arnold Schwarzbart had great advice that I gave something similar to someone teaching. You win some, you lose some. Sometimes you get rained out, but you have to dress for every game. Just sort of another version of play to the people who came. I agree with that, but I don't want to lecture to you when we have an intimate setting. So I'm going to try to share my comments in a more interactive way. I actually do want to watch because counterintuitively, discussions can be a lot longer than sermons, especially with you people. I can say that because I'm Jewish. So my preamble is roughly this. I got in trouble twice in my life for using the word guru. Once when I was at the drug and alcohol rehab Beit Tshuva, and once in a very early Hakol article I wrote here, someone sent me, I wouldn't say it was a nasty email, but a strongly worded email, someone who's not even part of the Jewish community. It was very frustrating to have to deal with this, that I used the word guru. I was using it in the way Peter Drucker, the management economist, uses it to kind of a polite word for a charlatan. But in both cases, someone points out to me that a guru is truly a religious leader in India, and not a charlatan in any way. There, at least, and I thought it was pretty clear that I was using the colloquial form of the word.
What's the word?
Guru.
Oh, cool.
Not to indicate a Hindi religious leader. That said, what I rail against is the idea that there are spiritual demigods out there. That someone could have or ought have greater access to the divine. I've encountered people who pose themselves as spiritually more attuned than you or I, and it's usually, as I've grown to understand what true spirituality is, and it's deeply connected with a vulnerability and an authenticity, those people tended to be a kind of arrogance, honestly, and an insecurity. But it's not always easy to see. If you see the Dalai Lama speak, you realize, has anyone seen the Dalai Lama speak?
No.
He spoke in Central Park when I was there. He does not come off as holier than thou in any possible way. He's very self-effacing, has an infectious laugh, is very lighthearted about deep spiritual matters. So, I'll cue certain points. I appreciate. This is all still preamble. This is the warm up. Give me a second. I haven't even gotten to the subject yet. So that being said, I have an aversion to concepts in Bible and elsewhere that propose an elevated level of spirituality. The Tanya also sets this up, that there are levels of spirituality that are near impossible to attain. I think that sets us up for failure. So prominent among them is in our parsha, Deuteronomy 18:13. It says, Tamim tihyeh im Adonai Elohecha. You ought to be tamim, pure, whole, or holy towards God, your God. To me, is one of those verses that sets up such an impossible standard of spiritual and religious life that I want to strike it from the Bible. Or I want to, not I want to. So I guess this is the first place I'll open to questions, but I have a few solutions. You know, there was a sermon here that was going to offer you solutions, but let's share in the solution process.
And yet, we have the prophets, and the prophets are quoted as the words of God. Human being speaking the word of God. So how much higher can you elevate a person over everybody else? What right do they have to say the words of God?
There's a lot of insight in that in your insert,
yeah.
Program insert. I did some wonderful writing on that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the prophets are quoted as part of the words of God.
Yeah, but how can we not be mortified when we're reading or read? No. Then we just have the reading of one of the most beautiful, and yet it doesn't say that everything is wonderful. The planet talks about how bad things have been, and it gives promise of hope. If we didn't have the prophets, you know, I think then, I don't see how Judaism, when it went through captivity and all those other things, would have ever been sustained. So, you know, you can make a case that yes, indeed, they got touched by something miraculous and shared it.
I think it's also possible to understand that, if not all, many of us hear a message distantly that we will try to convey to others. And that's a kind of prophecy. I also think you can make the challenge to that comment, as I do to high school students often, who come from a fundamentalist and literalist background. I said, even if Torah were, or Bible were given mouth to mouth by God, why would God write in the form of a history book or a science book? Wouldn't God write us in terms of poetry and art? And I think certainly Isaiah, that's clearly poetry. I mean, it's inspired you because of its poetic and affective richness. There was a Hasidic Rebbe who said if he could remember his Dvar Torah after Shabbat, it was because God hadn't spoken it for him.
You can see that from today, because it's so obvious they spoke the truth and everybody ignored them.
Yes. No, that's 100%, that's, yes. The prophet's job was very lonely. So where I was going to go, and I'd like to just push you a little in that direction away from prophets, is what I would think of as simplification and internality. Mindfulness might be a word for it. So Evan Ha'ezel, who was Isser Zalman Meltzer of Belarus about 150 years ago, let's say, there's a verse in, in the Parashah, not to plant an Asherah, which is some sort of fertility post or a post that represents the divine consort. Even early in our religion, there was an idea that God might have a special lady friend. So you're not allowed to plant that near tabernacle or temple. The reason for which seems self-evident. It's a kind of idolatry. But the Evan Ha'ezel, I think, writing so recently, so close to our time, would have said, well, it's not idolatry because there's no other God. So he notes that it's a kind of gilding the lily. That the temple itself, by nature of its being, not even by nature of its decoration, was so beautiful spiritually that it's planting anything, planting trees or flowers, would have been an unnecessary landscaping. So let me just a second, then you're next, yeah. It's exciting. The Torah is very exciting. Deuteronomy is very exciting. So I think that's a piece of the spiritual work. Becoming tamim is about a kind of pruning. Avoiding the unnecessary, refraining from, sometimes I think is a very powerful spiritual practice, you know, not answering a text message, putting your phone, not picking up your phone during a lunch you have with someone. Those are very hard modern refrainings, but I think at all points in the Jewish tradition, refraining from was a significant, you give me a nod like I'm not, no, yeah. Pork, I mean, yeah, bacon would be the obvious one. Yes, oh yes, I would not, yes.
No, we didn't come to it easily. I think give us a lot of credit along the way. We took a long, long time to go from monolatry, where our God's the best God, to monotheism, where there is no other.
Right, oh yeah.
That wasn't so doggone easy.
Certainly the best class I took during our seminary year in Israel, and one of the best classes I took, period, was George Savran taught the origin of biblical monotheism. It's a very thorny origin. I mean, it's very clear. It's hard to read it without the lens you come to the Bible with, but it's very clear that other gods have a real existence.
You mentioned about charlatanism. I was accused by an ex-sponsor of being a fraud, but I can talk about Tuesday at a Christian college in Kentucky, and afterwards my sponsor couldn't accept me as being a committed Jew, accepting whatever theory. And he said, you know, right, you know, I know for a fact, although I'm going to add a pet dinosaur.
What, which dinosaur, what kind? Okay, was it a triceratops or was it a meat eater?
Yes. There's no point to the faith of God's faith investment. He's so convinced that I was,
Yeah. Gina called that, and I had the experience of someone calling in about this, is sort of magical thinking. I was looking for a sign, and I happened to drive by a synagogue, and I was looking for a sign, and my divorce lawyer canceled our appointment. Of a rabbi having a consort? I know my wife would have a lot of, yeah.
Of God having a consort with Mary's birth and the Son of God, is there a connection?
Oh, that's good. John Shelby Spong might write about that. He writes about a connection between sort of Jewish myth and the Christian interpretation but that's a great question, but I've never investigated it.
That's a justification that there really was the Son of God.
Without a consort, without a spouse, the other spouse might think too highly of him or herself. You need a spouse to bring you back down to earth. Mimi?
Does God exist because we believe in him? If no one believed in God, would God exist still? You mentioned that other gods are very real. And I took that to mean real to the people who believe in them.
The first sort of up to the semicolon in your question, I can't answer, but the second part I've often thought, the description in Bible of the movement from what's also called henotheism or monolatry, the idea of a powerful God among many, to what we recognize as modern monotheism, I think is also a description of a historical trend of people ceding their worship to monotheism, and probably the peoples who supported other pieces of the pantheon losing their power or losing their worship or losing their religious system for various reasons. So our God won in more ways than one. So let me talk about another way of becoming tamim. So Isaiah Horowitz, known as the Shla or the Shnei Luchot Abrit, the two tablets of the law, he writes in Prague in roughly the 16th century. And I actually think he's related to the Horowitz musicians, but I can't recall if I'm just inventing that. So we start with this idea of shoftim b'shotrim t'iten lecha b'chol sharecha, that you ought to appoint guards and magistrates to your gates. So it's just one of those phrases that invites allegory very quickly. So he talks about the apertures of a body, eyes, this I think goes back to Midrash, two eyes, two ears, the mouth, two nostrils, and then of course he adds, Isaiah Horowitz adds, the generative organ and the excretory system. So he says, and he's not saying this directly about being tamim, chapter 18, verse 13, but he says that guarding these entrances and exits is a piece of holiness. You know, we being alert to what one says, to what one hears, the nostril being representative of anger in Hebrew idiom, how you get angry, how you control your anger, how much you eat to connect to the organs of excretion, how you procreate, that's a classic question, you know, that procreation and sensual love is permitted to us, but not wildly. You know, we're not intended to be promiscuous or take risks thereof, but but to do it appropriately and within the context of a romantic relationship. So I think this is a kind of, to me, a mindfulness, you know, that, for example, I think it's Aristotle who says, or some ancient Greek, there's a lot of debate if it said it, you have two ears, two eyes, and one mouth, and you're supposed to use them in that proportion. So, you know, just being modest and moderated and mindful about the way we use our capacities, and I think, again, that implies a certain refraining from and restraining ourselves from being smaller than we need to be, not going lifnim mishurat hadin, taking less than the law might permit us. I think that's a very powerful way to go up in holiness. Okay. That seems to me to go, I was almost going to say that in reflection to Barian's comment. Got it.
Go back to more
Rich?
This begs the question of what existence means, how God would exist in a perception of something.
That's a very hard question. Who was here? Only a few people were here when I made this comment, but the Pesuke de Zimra, the verses from Song, or just Pesuke as we know them. It's grammatically incorrect. The bookends to that section of the service are largely Baruch Shamar and Yishtavach, and at the end of both of those paragraphs, you have this phrase, Chei HaLamim, the life of the universe, which I think is the sort of the simplest and most irreducible concept of God, and one that almost all of us could agree to, that if God exists, God is the heart of the universe. God is either the sum total of the energy and momentum of the universe, or God is something that transcends that. Whatever else you might be willing to believe or have faith in, at the sort of the core is the idea that the universe has a meaning in its total, that the sum is greater than the parts, so to speak. So, you know, to me that goes to your question of the created world and God's role in it as goddess is somewhere as the sum that is greater than the part of all the atoms in the universe. My kids have taken me to asking me which has more atoms or how many atoms are in your fingernail. And I don't know how to explain to them. It's a number, like in your fingernail is already a number greater than you could write. Like you don't know, I don't think we, you know the name for that number. It's probably 18 zeros at that point, you know. It's, so. Is it a guess? It's just a guess? That's just honestly just a guess?
Oh,
okay. Times 10 to the 23rd, yeah. But that's, you know, and they're looking at a grain of sand, and they said, does this have like 1,000 atoms? I was like, no, I mean, you're already beyond 1,000 atoms at tiny scales. So I think, you know, purification of oneself is about simplification, it's about mindfulness, and I think it's about sort of constant practice, you know, ready and steady practice. So we get this, I love this, that the king keeps a copy of two copies of the Torah, one that he travels with and one that he sits by bedside. My rabbi had similar advice about rabbi's manuals. Keep one in your car, one at your desk, and one on the bima. You know, you never know when you're going to need to do a ritual really quick and you might be out of ideas. So I wanted to actually ask you about this. Patshegen is one of the characters in Purim, but he also... Onkelos translates that as a kind of translation. Do you know anything about this etymology? Okay. So between Onkelos, who is the earliest of the Aramaic translators, and the Sefer HaChinuch, one of my favorite sort of proto-law codes from about the 11th century, which may have been an ethical will to a child on bar mitzvah, and of course Rashi, they have different understandings of why the king has these copies. And it's called a Mishneh Torah, which is both the name for Deuteronomy, means a second Torah or a retelling of the Torah. It's also the name of Maimonides' law codes. So various commentators say that that's either a translation or something that he would carry in battle when doing judgment, when eating, that he would turn his eyes towards the Creator, or he'd keep a scroll in the treasury and a small scroll, a portable scroll. To me, that's about, you know, just regular practice. Like these efforts to be tamim, pure and holy, and to be mindful and to live in a certain kind of restraint are just continual. I mean, think so much of Jewish practice and any spiritual practice, whether it's yoga, Judaism, or even contemplating math, is a continual practice, meaning it's every day. You got to make your bed every day. You got to do the laundry every week, or in my house every month. It's not that bad, but it's a lot of laundry. So I just think that's a really powerful message, and I think it's in contradistinction to the idea of a guru. There's no one out there who attains enlightenment and sits on the mountaintop. Oh, you know what the best, that great joke about the woman, the old Jewish lady wants to go up to the guru on the mountaintop? Do you know this one? Don't ruin it. So she goes up to the mountaintop, and well, she gets to Nepal, and she's at the, you know, gets to the city, and she says, "I have to see the guru." And they said, "Well, you can't go. You're not even part of his faith." So I have to see him. I have an urgent question, and it's burning my soul. And she insists and insists, and finally she gets a ride to the mountaintop where he resides. She gets to the base of the mountain, and there are, you know, his guardians all around. And she insists and insists, and she says, "You can't. You know, you're just an old lady from the Bronx. Like, we don't. You're not even part of this system. You don't get it." She said, "No, I have to go. This question is really burning." And she gets to the top of the mountain, and there's like this, not a palace, but like a little shed where he dwells and contemplates. And she insists. She knocks on the door, and she insists to his guards, his sort of acolytes, "I have to go in. This is a really a vital question. It's been burning for years. He's the only one who can answer." And finally, with some encouragement, they let her in, and she yells, "Jerome, when are you coming home?" So, there's no one who does, and there's not much value to a sage on a mountaintop. I think even if you look at the Dalai Lama, like his engagement in the future of free Nepal indicates an engagement with the world that he didn't have to have, maybe, that he could have just stared at his navel. But true spirituality is an engagement with regular practice and other humans and community. And again, a preview of the holidays, David Brooks' Second Mountain teaches this a lot. That there is no sort of disconnected, transcendent spiritual experience for a human, at least not very much, that it's regular. And then there's a sort of inwardness that I think is really important, especially in our day and age with so many technological distractions and so life. The pace of life is somewhat fast. So we're told, I think it's Deuteronomy 18:16 in the Parsha, "Lo osef lishmo et kol Adonai Elohai v'et ha'esh ha'gedolah hazot." So Moses is recounting the revelation. He says, and that sound, the reverberations of God's speech did not stop, and the great fire was not quenched. So a more recent commentator says, you got to cultivate that faculty of hearing God continually. And also through God's voice, you hear God's voice through other means. It's not just your ears. It's perhaps all your senses. Perhaps you experience it in the sciences or in the arts. Perhaps you experience it through listening, but also through seeing and through observing nature. And again, just that's a process without end. And that sort of cultivating of gratitude for the basic created world and God's voice and the experience of God within it is steady work. Would that you be overwhelmed with gratitude in your life. I may address this a little on the holidays, but gratitude practices, even just keeping your gratitude journal morning or perhaps morning and evening, sitting out by a lake without your phone for an hour. I mean, if you can get yourself to a point where you're overwhelmed by gratitude, even amid stress, distress, sadness, grief, which are natural parts of life, that's a way to become tamim. To reach a kind of purity or a kind of holiness. So any further thoughts before I conclude? include with the something from the holidays?
Sorry.
No? No, absolutely.
That's what the Hasidim say, you're supposed to find ways to help work on
it. That's not Hasidic, that's Talmud. The idea that you should say 100 blessings a day is I think as old as the Talmud at least. Yeah. I mean, and that's the goal, right? Like it's not actually it would be extremely hard to get through a day with 100 blessings. You can get pretty close to like 40 on a typical day. But with the if you count the Amida, that's the question. But it would be hard to get to 100 on most days, but what? Right. Well, I think in the discussion it's not clear if the Amida is what they're talking about, but that gets you to that's 19 times, so it gets you to 57. That's the debate, sort of. I mean, even if you say the prayer services, that might get you to 70. But even finding 30 things, another 30 in a day outside of eating. Right, you gotta snack a lot. You gotta snack a lot. No, that's it. You gotta snack a lot to make it work. And live in a place where there are rainbows all the time. Yeah. It's 100% the conclusion we all came to is that would require a lot of snacking. Right. It's a lofty goal.
Right.
And I talked to our children, and I've talked to in other contexts about the prayer Modim, or Moda Ani Lefanecha. We talk about that as a gratitude prayer, but Lehitvadot, the root is actually acknowledgement. I mean, the root is really, I don't want to sound too new agey, but mindfulness. Like, it's not, and I think even in English, we might connect those two, that great gratitude is not about, oh, thank God I won the MacArthur Genius Grant. The gratitude is like, wow, the air smells really good this morning. I mean, it's just acknowledgement of the beauty all around you. Leon Hasden and I had a conversation, or I had a sermon based on a conversation with him, this idea that good things are coming to me. That's a sort of gratitude statement you can always say. It doesn't imply that you'll never get fired from a job. It doesn't imply that you won't experience loss. But I think it's understandable and true to say good things are coming. At some point today, you're going to eat something yummy. You know, something good is coming in the near future of some scale, which is not to deny the reality of evil or sadness. But the whole question comes to focus. And so, actually, it's going to perfect closing. The verse that concludes the psalm for the days of awe, which we say in Elul through sometimes through Yom Kippur and even later, is Kaveh al Adonai Chazak ve'ametz libecha ve'kaveh al Adonai. Direct yourself towards God. Let your heart be strong and brave, and look towards God. Direct yourself towards God, and that's it. All you know, practice, orientation, simplicity. And orientation towards gratitude and the divine and acknowledgement of the Almighty in your life, wherever, in small and big ways.